Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
I am back with Dr. Norman Curlin, who was on the show just this past week. I've had him join us again because what we got into was so interesting. We began with the pastoral letter of the bishops from the 1960s, Economic Justice for All, which he described as very deficient. And then we went into his own personal participation in the war on policy from the 60s, 70s. We're going to talk more about that today and his work for President Ronald Reagan. And we're going to talk more about some of the just basic concepts of economics so that this can be not just a nice learning experience for me alone, but for all of you. So, Dr. Curlin, welcome back to Church and Culture.
It's a great pleasure being with you, Gil. Thank you.
Well, you have a long and wonderful resume, but I want to pick up on one part of it, and that is that in 1985, President Reagan appointed you as deputy chairman of the bipartisan presidential task force on Project Economic Justice. You later published a piece on that entitled A New Look at Prices and Money, and another book on that you co-authored. But tell us about how this came about in your work with Ronald Reagan.
Well, it starts from knowing that Ronald Reagan, when in 1977, gave a number of speeches to young Americans for freedom. We have his speech. He wrote many articles then. He was then governor on Louis Kelso and why it's important to look at Kelso's ideas as expressed in Kelso's first book, which was with Mortimer Adler, who I know you knew Mortimer Adler
quite well,
and the book was called The Capitalist Manifesto. And I just want to say that I was unaware of the book. It was published in 1958. It's now on our website. It's free downloadable. Until 1965, when I was involved, as you mentioned, in the war on poverty, wrote the guidelines, for example, in the Community Action Program on maximum feasible participation of the poor. So this was something I was unaware of in trying to promote policies which would address the problems of the poor, how to do it. And I have to say that I didn't know, Milton Friedman did not know, the liberals did not know. Milton Friedman advocated a negative income tax, which is just a way of redistributing through the tax system. And then I became very disenchanted. I had been working for 5 years with the federal government on welfare and education law, segregation issues, got involved in what we called the Mississippi Project for the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. I was in their legal office and spent a lot of time in Mississippi. And I saw how a system could be changed despite overwhelming odds that most people would never think. And certainly the powers in control of Mississippi politics were confident, because they controlled the key committees of Congress.
Now, what exactly got changed?
Well, what got changed was by 1964, as a result of very intelligent process developed by people like Medgar Evers and the young people in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, they brought enough young people into Mississippi in 64. It was called the Mississippi Freedom Summer, and a law was passed, and that was the Civil Rights Law. And at the same time, in 64, because the civil rights movement at best had a policy of turning to the government to create jobs and welfare. And that was the best of their thinking, and that was the best of our thinking, my thinking, until I saw how poorly the government bureaucrats were in trying to help the poor to become organized in a peaceful way so that their point of view can be part of the whole process. They would be involved. And I knew that works because that's how SNCC and Medgar Evers, they organized poor people. And then the message finally got to the media, and that forced all the politicians. At least President Johnson was able to get the Civil Rights Commission, the civil rights laws, I should say. And this was and because I got disappointed, I was ready to quit. I didn't want to have anything to do with the bureaucracy and seeing how they operated from the top down and not trying to encourage the people. So just then somebody walked into my office, a man named Mark Goldies, who said, "Have you ever heard of Louis Kelso?" I said, "No." And he then began talking about it, and within 15 minutes, I said, "My God, why didn't I think of that?" Because I had been a lawyer, I studied the market system, I understood private property, I understood what profits were. I was not interested before then in the corporate sector. But suddenly, with Kelso's ideas, I could see that this was truly a revolutionary idea and responded to the problems that Marx saw. That is monopoly capitalism. Now,
but I want to go back for a second. In this report that you helped prepare for President Reagan,
right?
Yeah, did this Kelso Adler analysis play a part in that?
Of course, once I heard of it.
Yeah.
But how
was it received on the other side of the people who read it and so forth?
I think you have most people are ignorant of how a market economy operates, just as I have to say I hadn't really thought much about it as a result of being a lawyer. But one interested more in social change. And so I would say that it was popular. That is, I can remember when I first heard of this, I could tell you just what happened. I left the government and I became the director of planning for a group called the Citizens Crusade Against Poverty. And these were basically liberals, left-wing, even probably some of them were communists, but there were also some good people like Monsignor George Higgins, who was very much involved in the pastoral letter. But in any event, they were opposed. I brought Kelso in to speak at their first national group. There were 1,000 people there, and we had grassroots people. And the establishment, by and large, and by grassroots people, I'm talking about leaders within the poverty communities in Mississippi and Ohio and throughout the country. The liberals simply opposed it. But since there
was... Why did they so instantly oppose it?
Instantly opposed it.
Why?
Because it in their view, the state is how you deal with injustice. Instead, I saw you couldn't depend on the state to correct injustices in the system. You had to be able, it had to be done on principle, sound principle, moral principle, or one that respects every person and enables them to become fully human and compassionate with one another.
Well, let me then ask you to connect two things. You said earlier that you hadn't really understood what a market-driven economy is.
And I hadn't thought about it.
Yeah, but I understand, but what? How does a market-driven economy benefit the poor?
Okay, you see, the poor are outside of that because they're not, if we look at an economic system, there are two sides. You can't, you don't produce unless there are customers, so you have to look at consumption and production. You produce for customers, and you can't consume unless somebody or something has produced all the marketable goods and services. I shouldn't say that I didn't understand a market economy. Actually, I got the highest grade in the law in the economics side of the teaching at the University of Chicago. But I had to understand what Milton Friedman had to say, and I agreed with him about the democratic nature of a true market economy. Not necessarily.
So it has a democratic nature.
It has a democratic nature simply because in a market system, if it's a true free market system, every vote counts. In other words, people would what money is a way in which two people trade, or every contract is a form of money because there's a value. Both sides think that they're getting equal value because otherwise it would not be a fair contract. I understood that. But the fact is, poor people are not participating, either because they've lost their jobs, they're unemployed, but they're not participating as workers. And that's where the left, they only think of labor as the means by which wealth is produced. And it's just not true.
But do we live in a market-driven economy right now?
No, I don't think so. Not
what are we in? How would you describe the economy we're presently in?
Well, I would describe it as an economy in which not everyone participates as owners. And there should be equal participation of owners simply because it's the tools that differentiate today's economy than the economies over thousands of years.
Well, if a market-driven economy is democratic by nature, how did we end up with an economy that is leaving so many people behind?
Okay, because it's monopolistic in terms of the money system.
Explain that to me and our listeners. That's very important. How is it monopolistic?
Well, first of all, most people do not have the means by which they can become owners of what's changing in the system. What's changing in the system is not that people are more productive. That is, labor is becoming.
Can you couch this? I mean, a home is one of the most fundamental things that I think that people desire to own.
But a home is like. And it doesn't produce an income. You have to have, if you're going to own it, you're going to have to get credit, and you're going to have to pay for that credit. The home doesn't pay for itself. If you buy a home for others and you had the money to buy to own it, then you get a rent, and that's fair. But a home, while it's very
so, you have to have the. Wherewithal to purchase a home.
I'm an owner of the home or food or any, or be able to purchase. So you have to participate in the productive process.
Okay, let's go back to your comment that there's a monopoly on the money.
Okay.
Explain that.
That's where the problem is, and this is where you can find Karl Marx, you can find Keynes, who brought us the New Deal, really. He was behind that. And you can even find Milton Friedman on the right. And that is, they think that the only way you can become an owner of capital, which is what's changing, is past savings. Well, the only ones who have significant past savings...
What do you mean by past savings? You mean money you just put away?
That you got an income, but you did not spend it all.
Okay.
As I say, the purpose of production is consumption. So if you don't spend it all, there's not what economists call demand. If there's not demand, you don't produce. That's why the U.S. economy is much slower than it was during the Second World War. In after the Depression was over, when we were...
Are you saying that people are saving right now?
I'm saying, of course, if you... Not all people. I'd say the wealthiest are saving because
because they're able to.
But there's no way they can buy, they can do anything with their excesses but to invest in new capital. Okay? So that 0.1% of the American public own over 90, more than the bottom 90% combined in most...
But it's not... However, it's not their fault, is it?
It's not their fault. It's because of the system that it thinks that the only way that you can become an owner is to have those accumulations.
Tell us what they're missing. What is it they don't understand?
Kelso... and Adler in their second book, which was called The New Capitalist, but its subtitle said precisely what the problem was. It was a proposal to free economic growth from the slavery of past savings. Well, what did he mean? What did they mean by that? It meant that future savings, credit, is only a set of promises people can make. And banks once supplied credit for capital growth that was available without past savings, as long as there was because it would be an asset-backed currency. Today, certainly the American dollar is not based on assets.
Are you saying that the poor don't have access to credit?
Exactly. It's credit, which is only a social thing, that banks evaluate that, and that is if you want to...
Well, the government, Norman, as you well know, the government has cracked down on subprime credit cards, payday lending. It seems to me the government has done a lot in the last 10 years to make credit much less available to the poor.
When I began working with Kelso, we were able to get the laws so that workers could buy out their companies 100%.
But hold on. I don't want to get there yet.
Okay, but...
Are you in agreement with me that the government has cracked down on credit for the poor?
Oh, there's no question.
And, of course, and also the credit, credit rating plays a huge role.
But that's the credit rating is done on the past, your whatever you've done in the market and in the past. If you're that tiny fraction, that 0.1%, they don't have a problem.
Are you also saying, Norman, essentially that the folks with the money don't want to take a risk?
They do. Obviously, when they invest in a company, they do. And incidentally, one of the things that I disagree with the left on, they think the rich are the problem or the greedy are the problem. No, it's the system that's the problem. So
who is responsible for this system?
We are. We are. Just as the founders of America, you can get it right from the preamble of the Constitution. It says, we the people. It didn't say, we the rich or we the poor. No, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union. And then they said, you should establish justice. And that's where the failure is. That the principles of justice that Kelso and Adler talked about taught me something, because they are so perfect in terms of designing a system that will work for the benefit of every human being, every child, every woman, every man.
But it's one thing to design not a utopia, I don't mean that, but an ideal economic system.
Well, why not?
It's quite another to make over the present one.
Well, yeah, but you see, if it's reforming the present one. It isn't that everything is bad. No. But what is bad?
What's the first thing you would do if you were king?
Sure.
Or you were Trump?
Yeah.
What's the first thing you would do?
What's the first move you would make? If I were a leader, is to bring out what is it? What is the meaning of this just third way that goes beyond socialism and
No, I don't want that answer. I know that your general program is called the Just Third Way.
Start with a vision.
Ask you the vision stuff. I've always been, ever since Clinton, I've been really, really suspicious of people who talk about vision.
Well, because...
And of course, I'm kidding, Norman, but...
No, but you see, Clinton used the term third way, and his was...
Hold on, Norman. I asked the questions.
Right. Okay.
I want to know, what's the first concrete change you would make?
The first thing I would teach, so that you get the people to understand. I would have academia teaching principles, logic,
you've done that. Everybody's teaching. Everybody's learning. What would you do?
Let's assume that we've done that.
Yeah.
Then what I would do, just as we did with the employee stock ownership plans, you find a champion, or if I were president, I would then have the Congress, I would bring in the leaders of Congress to say, pass the Capital Homestead Act. In other words, a total system. What changes are necessary in the monetary policy? What changes are necessary in the tax policy? And what changes even in inheritance and gift tax laws that would encourage more equal, not results.
Now you've given me something I can work with, because everybody listening to this knows about tax laws, knows about inheritance laws,
right,
and these things.
Right.
So
I have to ask what specific changes would I make to the monetary policies and monetary reform? First of all, the government doesn't create money; it's the Federal Reserve. So I would make sure that the Federal Reserve policies made it possible for local banks, and both commercial banks as well as cooperative banks, to make loans to people.
Do they not do that presently?
Oh, not again. Sure, for the wealthy, for people with enormous amounts of savings. Yes, of course, because.
But that gets back to my point about them not wanting to take a risk.
Well, I'm saying, I'm not concerned with what the rich do with their accumulations. They can do whatever they want. I wouldn't take it away from them. Okay? If the question is, we need a couple $1 trillion every year, which amounts to roughly $7,000 per child, per woman, per man, per year, in a slow growth, and it could be 2 to 3 times that, but I want to be conservative.
If you go to the banks and ask them to do that, they'll say, sure, give me the money.
That isn't what credit is. You see, credit is the money, so that it's the bank that actually provides the credit and also makes sure that the risk of default can be covered. And in the proposal, that would all be taken care of. How? Because, yes, there's a risk, but there's an industry that handles risk. You know what industry handles risk? It's insurance, of course.
Yeah.
See, but they don't yet offer capital credit insurance. In other words,
what does that mean?
Over the purpose of the loan, will it be made in such a way that you could buy shares in the companies that are growing the economy? So you have to look at a new way in which the trillions of dollars needed for growth, so that we can get back to not using tariffs to prevent free markets, but rather they would have the bank itself would do an assessment of the risk on particular shares that would be sold in the market. The types of shares would be full dividend payout shares, voting shares. It would also encourage corporations to pay out their profits fully so that they would eventually be taxable at the individual level. And so all you have to do is give the corporations a way in which if they pay out their profits through dividends on these shares in the future, they'd be tax deductible at the corporate level, which we're now doing with ESOPs.
Hold on right there, and we're going to come around to ESOPs after a short break, talking once again with Dr. Norman Curlin. We're trying to learn something about economics, about markets, about how to fix a system that is far too unequal in terms of the distribution of wealth without getting into government redistribution. So we'll be back after this short message with Dr. Norman Curlin.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, Chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
There were some Greek-speaking Jews in Jerusalem who'd come to the feast, and they asked Philip, "Sir, we'd like to meet Jesus." And Philip went to Andrew, and then they told Jesus, and he answered, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Amen, amen, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains just a grain of wheat. But if it dies, it produces much fruit. Whoever loves his life loses it. Whoever hates his life in this world will preserve it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me. And where I am, there also will my servant be. My Father will honor whoever serves me. I am troubled now, yet what should I say? Father, save me from this hour. But it's for this purpose that I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name." And then a voice came from heaven, "I have glorified it and will glorify it again." The crowd there heard it and said it was thunder. But others said, "An angel has spoken to him." Jesus answered, "This voice didn't come for my sake, but for yours. And when I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw everyone to myself." He said this, indicating the kind of death he would die. Jesus went to his death in full knowledge of what awaited him. This was the price he paid to save you and to save me. I'm Father Pat Egan, Chaplain 12 AM Radio, commenting on the readings read this Sunday at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
Back with Dr. Norman Curlin. I've warned him, I'm going to ask him about taxes, tax rates, and what kind of tax rates he thinks would provide the kind of opportunity for more people to have access into ownership and into creation of wealth. Norman, what is your preferred tax system? I take it it's not the present one based upon marginal tax rates.
It's not right. Graduated or progressive tax rate. That it would not be that. It'd be a flat tax, a single tax on all income at the personal level. Okay, so that you would incur, not all taxes would be exempt at the corporate level or the enterprise level, but rather you would give the enterprise an opportunity to become tax exempt by paying out its profits.
Well, hold on just a second. Let's not talk about corporations. Let's talk about individuals.
Well, but you know.
Yeah, but why? But why is a flat tax the most just tax?
Well, as I say, it's, well, first of all, you're not going to get the kind of deficits that we have, in which the amount of the deficits are just the official deficits. I have some numbers.
So would a flat tax result in higher revenue for the government?
It would result in government being attacked. It'd be a rate at which any government spending would be covered by the income through the tax system. So the question is, what would be the ideal system that would allow the government never to have a deficit? As a matter of fact, to begin paying back the deficits of the past, which today most people don't know that there's officially in. It's about $21 trillion.
Yeah, we talked about this last week, but my question is, yeah, what general percentage do you think that tax rate would need to be? I've heard 13% thrown around.
It might be 13%, but first you have to listen to hear the system so that you can then see that you can do things in a more logical way that will make the economy more, that you'll begin to eliminate poverty. It's not all going to take place overnight.
Well, why does the flat tax help to do that?
Okay, because you won't go into more debt. And behind the U.S. currency today are no assets. Currency is supposed to be backed by assets. Okay? The money system is...
Well, how does having a deficit impact the poor? How does that work?
Having a deficit that, you're dealing with debt, government debt, as the assets behind...
I know, but how does that impact people?
Well, let's,
in Appalachia and other places that are trapped in poverty?
Okay, only if you look at the whole system. You can't take a piece. So then you'll see how you take care of the poor in Appalachia or in any poverty community. Again, you start by recognizing that profits are the key, not the enemy of the future. It's a way to make the flat tax rate be a rate at which whatever the government wants to spend for war, for welfare, or whatever it wants to spend, there'll be the money coming out of the productive
system. Well, who has made profit the enemy?
If you know what the government wants to spend, and you know what the incomes that would be derived through the tax system, you have a balanced budget. And if you do that, you might increase that flat rate to something so that we can begin to get rid of the deficits. You see, I was trying to tell you that if you look at the real debt, which is more than the $21 trillion, if you look at Social Security, Medicare, and all the entitlements and various other spending, it gets to $344,000 per citizen, or $927,000 per taxpayer. Yeah. Now, this is the debt.
We know, Norman, we've talked
okay.
about
if that. If we know that.
Now, let me ask you this question.
What it's going to take to begin to pay down that debt, but stop going into deficits. The flat tax will be set at such a rate, knowing what will be taxable, that will pay for that. So until we can talk about that, both at the corporate level, and at the corporate level, what you would do is allow the corporation, if it pays out its profits so that it becomes taxable at the personal level, then it would be tax deductible. And this is what we're able to do under present law for workers today. Okay.
Now, what's your position on the inheritance tax?
Well, my position on the inheritance tax is to encourage wealthy people, because they can't take the property with them, but not take anything, don't attack their property rights in existing assets. So what you would do, instead of taxing the estate, you encourage the wealthy to taxing the recipient. If the recipient, let's say, gets over $1 million, you tax what they have over $1 million or $2 million, whatever number you want to pick, you see, and that would encourage them to spread it out among their family, the workers who helped create this.
You mean do it, get rid of it before they die?
No, they put it into their will. This is how, or when they make a gift.
But isn't an estate tax, regardless of whether it's who is
but
given
again,
to?
Again, who you, if you don't, if your estate tax is on $50 billion. Well, and you give it to one person, so that $50 billion, that concentration is there for people who didn't really earn it.
Okay. So you're in favor of estate tax.
But supposing you could distribute it to priests or to...
Well, hold on just a second.
Or to...
You know, we're not talking about the person with $50 billion.
Teachers or...
Norman.
Politicians.
Norman.
Problem. Tax
Norman.
The recipient. I'm saying this is logical.
Yeah, hold on. I need to get clear here. We're not talking about a guy with $50 billion.
Well, then we're
talking about somebody with maybe $1 million or $2 million, which isn't a lot of money these days.
I wouldn't tax them. To me, that's not significant, and they can do with it. I think you have to think about the 0.1% to 1%.
Well, I want you just to address whether or not should there be an estate tax.
Inheritance tax should recognize that a certain amount is not causing the kind of monopolistic form of capitalism that we have. You have a monopoly. Now, the point is, can we address that monopoly in a way that's consistent with private property and free markets and limited government? Can we do that? We say yes.
Are you in favor of estate taxes?
Okay, but... Again,
are you? Yes or no?
But you want to encourage it when it goes to others than the owners, whether they're family members, workers, teachers, politicians, musicians, whatever, encourage them to spread it out. You're not forcing them to spread it out, but you just design the law so you tax the recipients. There's no big deal about that.
Well, I mean, what difference does it make whether you're taxing the recipient or
they have,
the estate itself?
They have over $1 million, $2 million.
No, stop.
Whatever.
Stop. What difference? If it gets taxed, the estate gets taxed before it is distributed, or it gets taxed after the individual receives it, what difference does it make?
Well, because if the individual receives $1 billion, then most of that billion is going to be subject to a tax.
Why? Is that a good idea?
Yes, it is, because if it's subject to a tax, that will mean that your personal income taxes will be lower, because you'll have a source, you'll have an additional source of government revenues.
So you're saying that estate tax is a good idea because it keeps other taxes down?
As I said, it would be changing gift and estate taxes from the person who is today very, very wealthy, and when he makes out his will, it would go to many people, including family members.
It doesn't have to.
If it have to, then it will be taxed.
Are you saying if somebody decides to give it to two people rather than one, it won't be taxed?
I'm saying if you give, yes, if you have people with $60 billion estates. Now, if you give that to two people, let's say you split it, so you have $30 billion each. They can't spend it. They can't spend it. If they could, that would increase market demand, so you'd be able to produce more. But they can't.
Wait a minute.
They don't.
I'll grant you the billion. I'll grant you the billionaire.
You want to look.
But the estate taxes that I'm asking you about are where you say somebody dies with $3 million, they've got three kids, and each kid's going to get $1 million.
There'd be no tax.
Okay. That's all I wanted to know. That's what I was trying to get to.
You know, for ordinary people, yeah.
Yeah. So you're really talking about estate tax for the top.
We should be recognizing that this is a way in which you encourage the democratization in the future, democratization of ownership opportunities. And you're not having it done by government, but rather by the those who possess.
By the way, to go back to the flat tax,
okay.
would there be deductions? Would a corporation like Amazon be able to pay no taxes in a given year? That kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly.
They wouldn't be able to get away with that.
Yes, we're doing it already with ESOPs. That companies that are 100% owned by what's called an S corp combination with ESOPs, they pay. The companies pay no corporate taxes. All the profits are going to be taxable at the individual level. That is, the workers will be paying the personal tax.
Do they pay it year by year?
Of course.
So
if they have over.
So I'm not. Let's take out the ESOP companies. Okay.
Well, then all we're doing is using that as a good example of.
I know, but I'm saying let's talk about a non-ESOP company.
Under
the flat tax.
Right now, they don't get deductions for paying out dividends.
Well, how does Amazon then avoid paying taxes?
No, they pay taxes. But I'm trying to say,
according to what I read, they didn't pay any taxes last year.
Well, maybe they didn't. Okay, they may have had enough deductions, so they paid nothing. Okay, so they, but you can be sure that they had profits.
Would there be deductions in the flat tax system?
Yeah, under a flat tax system, if they paid out their profits as dividends.
Now you're going back to the ESOP model again.
Oh, I know. I'm talking more.
I know, but I want to know what would be the impact on a non-ESOP company.
Future, what we call a Capital Homestead Act, and that is the tax portion would allow corporations to escape from paying corporate taxes. They would pay corporate taxes if they didn't pay out their dividend, their profits. But,
so in other words, this bill would strong arm companies into an ESOP system.
Well, if you see, again, ESOP is corporate employees. It doesn't include public sector employees. It doesn't include nonprofit companies' employees. So you have to find a way in which. And this is a fundamental human right under the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
What if a group of employees don't want it?
That is always the choice. That's mm-hmm. the point we're trying to make.
I mean, I don't see why they would not want it. But Norman, at this point, I need you to explain once again. I know you did it on the last show. Exactly what an ESOP is.
Oh, yeah. An ESOP is a means by which workers can become owners of the companies for which they work. You know, I'm just finding out this is incredible, since we talked, but I discovered that there's a company in China. It has It's the largest company in China. They produce cell phones and all. It's all employee owned, and which I found incredible. And the first person who founded it 30 years ago only owns 1.4% of the total company. And it's, you see, so if China, I'm afraid that China, if they begin to adopt what this fella has done as a model, and he works all over, that is, as I say, he probably, I know in 2014, they had $82 billion of earnings around the world. And so if China does it and the United States sits and talks about it.
By the way, Norman, I'll take 1% of that. Now, let me ask you this. What size company, what critical mask size does there need to be for an ESOP to work?
Well, whatever the size would work at any level, as long as the company is feasible. That is, it's able to provide something to the market that is better than others. So it could be a small company, but in general, we're talking about small companies. But there are some that are billion-dollar companies that have ESOPs, and what they do is set up a retirement plan using the ESOP, and what it is a way that the company can either issue new shares or use credit to buy outstanding shares from the shareholders who want to sell at a market price. And it can all be done.
But this doesn't come out of the pocket of the employee.
No, it doesn't come out of the pocket at all. Because the employee, see, under the wage system, what used to be 25 cents an hour or even less back in history, now we're talking about $15 an hour. Think about what that means in terms of America's ability to compete in the world with countries whose wage levels are so much lower and who today are acquiring some of the technologies that Americans have produced.
So in other words, if let's say you're in a moderate sized company.
Right.
The company, what convinces ownership to want to have an ESOP in their company?
Well, if you look at the particular, they realize that ownership will unite the people into a team who will all be there as servants. So you need servant leadership, what I call servant teacher leadership. What does that mean? It means taking the pyramid that most companies are formed with, where the power is at the top, the pharaoh is at the top, and everybody better listen to that pharaoh. But we turn the pyramid upside down so that the true leader is one who inspires and teaches and encourages others to do that, but at the base now is at the top. And who are they? The customers. So any company that wants to succeed, if you turn it upside down, where everybody is there serving the customers, you're going to and they serve and they provide higher quality than anyone else, they're going to succeed and make profits. And incidentally, you see, the wage system is what's killing us. And this is what both the left and the right believe in, that everything is labor, a wage system. In the meantime, you have robots that are going to, in 13 years, Americans are saying 70 million jobs will be lost to robots. And there's no problem if you own the robots and you get the fruits that are being contributed by the robots. And robots now are able to produce robots. So until we understand that technology is making it easier and easier to produce marketable goods and services for the world, should be able to do so so that the prices of a country that has the plan, a just third way plan, will have lower prices, but high quality, but also will do so in such a way that those people who are displaced from economic forms of work can be free, as Aristotle said in the past, will be free to engage in the work of civilization, politics, teaching, and health. When people have an income, that's the key. They need an income, and it should be income that they earn. And if they own the robots, the fruits of the robots will be an earning, a form of earning that today is available to a handful of human beings.
Well, you know, Norman, it sounds to me like you've got to have the willingness of those who now are part of the monopoly, as you call it.
Well,
let me finish. They have to be willing to enter into this kind of relationship with those who work for them.
I disagree with your premise. And the reason I say this, that some will agree and some will not. So it's simply because it's so different that they want to be like the pharaohs on the pyramid. Okay? So I would not depend on them, although I would encourage those of them who are really interested in the future of humanity and civilization to back it. And we had some wealthy people backing, and there still are.
You're going to change corporate tax law or corporate tax rates
by encouraging ordinary people to wake up to what can provide them an opportunity that they cannot get to, or few will. Yes, I shouldn't say that nobody starting from nothing can become a billionaire. We know that they can, but there are exceptions. Well, we're talking about not a tenth of 1% of a population. It's probably, when you look at the world population, it's a handful of people. That doesn't make sense because you must be able to earn, and certainly you must be able to get the ownership opportunity, equal ownership. Why? Because it gives you the right to the fruits, and it gives you power that people don't have. And under today's system, we're moving from independent citizens, as in the beginning of this country, to where more and more citizens are dependent on the state. And the state is not a god. The state is our only legitimate monopoly. And if you want to be and what is that monopoly? It can kill you. It can force you into war. It can jail you. Whatever. Under communism, where the state is the only owner, and that's where we're moving toward under socialism and all forms of collectivism. You see, if you're looking for the moral basis, we would call it not just personalism. That would be the only ism that I would back, but economic personalism. And I think that the present Pope is one who's talking about the problems that we have in the economy. Say no to an economy of exclusion. Say no to the idolatry of money. Say no to a financial system which rules rather than serves. Say no to the inequality which spawns violence. You can in all.
Yeah, but Norman, we're coming to the end of our time. I don't think he is with you.
Yeah.
The Pope, I mean, when it comes to not looking at redistribution as the solution, but that's going to give me the last word, I'm sorry to say, but I do agree that our Holy Father is talking about all the right things, even if he doesn't have the kind of answers that you and I think are correct. I want to thank you, Dr. Norman Curlin, for being a guest again, a lively one once again on Church and Culture. We look forward to talking to you the next time.
Thank you. Always ready.
Thank you, Doctor.
Pretty much.
And to all of you listening, I'll be back on this day at this time next week.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.